I'm going to use a mic because we're recording the evening, because there's quite a few people who couldn't make it tonight and are going to listen to this. We're going to download it and put it on the Process Work Institute website. So when folks ask questions, if you can raise your hand and I'll bring the mic to you so it all gets recorded. So I'll now talk a little bit about our evening. This evening is part of one of the events that the Process Work Institute puts on three times a year called the Research Symposium. And actually, it's particularly exciting this year because Caroline, who is going to be presenting this evening with Heather, was the individual who originally founded the Research Symposium and organized them. So that's exciting. And it's a time when individuals who have been doing research in the field of process work or related topics come and share the work that they're doing in the community. And so this evening, we have a very exciting evening. Dogs as Therapists, and Heather Omart and Caroline Spark, here with both Healy and Thistle, who are sort of hiding in the back, are going to present their work. And I'm just going to say a little bit about Caroline and Heather, and then pass things over to them. So Heather Omar has a certificate in animal-assisted therapy activities and learning, and is a certified dog trainer who specializes in raising and training puppies for service and therapy work. She runs the Canine Companion for Independence Puppy Raising Program at a local correctional facility and volunteers in the mental health unit there with her therapy dogs, Healy and Thistle. Heather is interested in partnering with Portland area mental health professionals to develop innovative animal-assisted therapy programs. And Caroline Spark is a certified dog trainer and behavior consultant, and she's worked for many years as a mental health practitioner. She was on the faculty of the Process Work Institute and remains a member of the Process Work Learning Community. Caroline has a special interest in training dogs for service and therapy work and in developing services that foster the human-animal bond and enrich the lives of working dogs. And many of us here have also had the honor of having had Caroline as a teacher and a supervisor also. So I'm just going to pass it over to them. They have their little mics. And anything else that I should add? Is that good? Okay, thank you. And it's a real honor to have the two of you. So thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that nice welcome. I think, is that too loud? Am I booming a little bit? Does it sound okay? Sounds loud to me. Okay. Thank you for having us this evening. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm delighted to be here with Heather, who's a colleague. She works with City Dog Country Dog, which is the dog training and behavior consulting business that I started as I was transitioning from working as a psychologist to moving into working just with dogs and their families. So tonight we thought we have a couple of phases of the presentation. We're going to talk a bit about sort of the concept of animal-assisted therapy and the history of it. And then, and I'm going to cover that part, and then Heather is going to be doing some really interesting things with the dogs and going more into the practical side of things. We do hope that by the end of the evening, if any of you have interests in any of the things that we've talked about, that you might want to talk to us now or afterwards. We've got our cards there in the back. We are very interested in partnering with local psychologists, mental health practitioners, social workers, to provide a therapy dog team that might perhaps work with you and some of your clients. So do let us know if that might be something you're interested in. So what we thought we'd first of all do, because for sure the most important beings in this room tonight are in fact Healy and Thistle. So we thought you might want to meet them. If you don't want to meet them, just put your hand up. You don't have to say, you don't have to explain, but if for any reason you don't feel like interacting with a dog, just say, and Heather will move them on. One of the really important things in working with animal-assisted therapy is that it is about choice. You don't have to. When they go visiting, people don't have to. And they won't feel upset if you don't want to meet them. which is why they're really good therapists. They don't judge and they don't get personally affected in the same way that we do. So, Heather, would you like to bring them around? And as you'll see, they really love meeting people. And dogs. So the question was, are they related? But probably, but distant is the answer to that one. So as you can see, they really don't like their jobs very much, right? Their tails are wagging like crazy for those of you that are on the listening to the audio thing after.
Do you want to mention the eggs on their bags around
about? Yeah. Heather, do you have, can you put your mic on? And the question was about the tags on their coat.
They are both therapy dogs at a correctional facility, and those are the vests that they wear when they go to work there. Yeah, they're happy to do that.
They like to visit with everyone for a lot longer, by the look of it. Yes. Mm-hmm. Oops, sorry, it's a bit loud. Oh yeah.
Not as a non-dog owner, but a dog enjoyer.
Yeah.
As they're going around, what are they doing?
What are they doing?
Yes. You can't tell us what a dog is thinking, but they're going around, they're being so incredibly into everybody.
Yes.
But I'm just curious about their interaction style and...
Heather, do you want to answer that?
These dogs were trained to be service dogs, and so they're very in tune with their handler. And it took a while for both of them to kind of go outward and look towards other people. So I'm usually pretty free about letting them do that because they spent 2 years learning to just focus in on their handler. So they're just very social girls now, and they really enjoy interacting with people. The nice thing about working with them too is they don't have any judgments. They don't, you know, if somebody is drooling, if they're trembling, if they're, in a suicide jacket, it just doesn't faze them. So they're happy to interact with that person just as happy as they are anybody else, which is really a nice feature of them. Come on, Thistle, let's go.
Looks like you're a chosen one. So,
come on, Healy. You going to just hang out with them?
Shall I start this or should
go
I?
Go ahead and yeah, start.
Okay. So, we thought we would actually... Oh, look, there's another little somebody here. Yeah. I didn't realize. We actually have two little dogs on laps tonight. What's this one called? Mimi, 6-year-old Yorkie, so tiny I didn't even see her. And then there's Junebug over there, who's a 2-year-old, 3-year-old Border Terrier. And June looks like she's waiting for the TV to start. So I might take my cue from her. So we're going to start with my part of the presentation, unless anybody has a pressing question about the dogs as they come round. Is that good with everyone? Should we just start with that? Okay. So, glasses. So, just want to welcome you all, obviously. Those are three of the dogs that Heather has raised or had visiting with her at one time. Do you want to say who they are, Heather?
Far right, and then the lower one is Tanj, and he's also
So Healy, who's here tonight, and two service dogs who are now working. Yes.
What's the distinction between canine companion and service dog?
Okay, that's a good question. So distinction between service dogs, therapy dogs, companion dogs, and dogs who perform what's called animal-assisted therapy. So, I mean animal-assisted activities. So we're going to talk about the difference between animal-assisted therapy and animal-assisted activities a little later on. Very simply, a service dog is a dog who's trained to perform tasks or work for an individual with a disability. So the dog is owned by that person and works for that person, whereas a therapy dog is a dog who either visits facilities or lives in a facility or is basically there to provide some kind of help or support, but not for the person who owns that dog. Yeah, so they visit or they work. Therapy dogs, strictly speaking, really perform tasks that help a professional in achieving goals with clients. So I'll come to that more in a minute. Right, so here we go. I said some of that. You might just reflect just for a moment on how you felt when you met the dogs. What sort of feelings come up in you? Or perhaps if you have clients in your professional practice, do clients in your practice come to mind who these dogs and how they interact? How that might benefit somebody that you know. Dogs aren't everybody's cup of tea, that's for sure. But for some people and some mental health conditions or learning goals or a variety of other tasks that we'll be mentioning, they're just what the person needs. So, and sometimes it's just as simple as, the dog comes up to you and wags its tail and you just feel like $1 million because somebody just seems to like you on sight, and irrational as it may seem, it always makes me feel good. Yeah. So what I'm going to cover is a little bit about what is animal-assisted therapy, what's the distinction between that and animal-assisted activities, a little bit about the power of the human-canine bond and about dogs in different types of settings, therapeutic settings. And then I want to just briefly conclude with therapy for the therapy dog, because this work, much as the dogs who do it love it, it also takes something out of them, and how do we give back to those dogs and keep them healthy. For the therapists amongst us here, we all know the importance of supervision and, getting our own therapy. So it's true for therapy dogs as well. So a couple of definitions. So animal-assisted therapy, the key thing about that is that it's delivered or directed by a professional, someone who's providing mental health or other services, and the dog serves the goal of that particular work. Animal-assisted activities is different in that it involves visiting with a dog and going into all sorts of situations, nursing homes, hospitals, there's programs reading for dogs, there's occupational therapy, there's just all kinds of different things that dogs can do that help adults and kids learn or grow in certain ways. And although we're talking about dogs here, there's lots of different animals that do these things, dolphins, horses, rats, hamsters, cats, birds. So, what did you say? Lizards? Lizards! Hello, Lise. Yes. An animal-assisted lizard intervention. So, here are some things that the differences that are involved in the two things. So, you can see how all of the ones on the right are taking place in a specific context towards a specific goal. And the goal is tailored to each patient or client, and the treatment process is different, or the therapeutic process is specifically for that person. So the whole thing takes part as is part of a therapeutic process. Animalistic activities are much more casual. There's no particular goals in mind necessarily. And you can do the same thing with lots of different people. They can be short visits or longer visits, so long as the dog's doing well in that setting. So usually what we think of as animal-assisted therapy is actually animal-assisted activities. So for example, if you have a dog and you think, oh, I'd like to take that dog to a hospital and visit with people, it's actually going to be animal-assisted activities that technically you're doing. But broadly speaking, we usually just call it therapy dogs, because who can say animal-assisted activities quickly many times over? It's a bit of a mouthful.
Question. On the therapy piece, do you need to stay with one dog, or can you go with different animals and still accomplish the therapeutic goals?
Want to answer that? You
can definitely use different...
Turn your thing on. Yeah.
It is on.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Yeah. You can use different dogs, different animals, to achieve the same goal. In fact, I use these two in very different ways. One of them's very affectionate and likes to get close to people, so I might use her in a completely different way than I would use Healy, who's more task-oriented and likes to do commands and training and things like that. So I can utilize them both in whichever way I need to.
And that makes a really good point, I think, about how all dogs are different, and different dogs suit different types of work, and it's important that the dogs really love what they do, else they're not going to be good at it and they won't be so healthy. So that brings me to this point, which is not all dogs are suitable for therapy work. I think they're born and made. Some of it is temperament. It's in them. They're calm, they like people, they like other dogs, they just love what they do, and they've always been that kind of dog. Good-natured, even-tempered. There are some things that you can't really train. Socialization, which is sort of a technical term for exposing a dog in a positive way to all the things that that dog will experience as an adult when the dog is very young. That's important. It can certainly make a big difference as to how well a dog does in the world. And training, obviously, is necessary, but without that basic temperament, yeah, the same as not everybody wants to be a therapist, right, with people, and it's the same with dogs. So in order for a dog to become a therapy dog, the dog has to go through, well, for them, I can't say totally, because it's also true that some psychologists and mental health practitioners, social workers may actually have a personal dog who they use in their practice, who accompanies them and works with their clients. I did that with a dog who wasn't technically a therapy dog. She did get her certification later, but you know, if you have a dog who just loves snuggling up with your clients, and you have clients who love being snuggled up with by a dog, and that's all it takes, some people do that. And for the most part, though, dogs should be certified, especially if they're going into institutions like hospitals. And there are a number of certifying bodies. Delta Society is the big one, but there are other ones listed there as well. And there's actually quite a lot more than just those few. So if you're interested in finding out more about therapy work for yourself or for the organization you work with, you might want to check out the Delta Society's website, which has tons and tons of information about service dogs and therapy dogs as well. So now a little bit about history. Now, I find this very interesting. Dogs have been used forever in a therapeutic way. They've served us, we've served them, we've built a relationship over millennia. But in modern Western history, it seems, from what I could find out, that it was in the late 18th century that animals were first started to be used in an institutional setting to help patients. This was actually a Quaker institute, I think, for mental health, where they kept domestic animals and the patients were allowed to wander around and interact with the animals. And it was intended that they used less drugs and restraints as a result of the animals. Interestingly enough, when drugs started to be used more and more, the use of animals started to go down. Like there was a shift towards more medicalization and use of drugs, medication, which, you know, had its great things, but then this sort of more natural interaction with animals and the therapeutic effect of it got lost, and now it's coming back and it's growing. There's lots and lots and lots of use of animals in therapeutic settings now. So here's another interesting slide on that topic, that Bethlehem Hospital, which is where the term Bedlam comes from, some of you might know, it was a huge psychiatric institute which was so ghastly at some level and so chaotic, it became known for its like terrible conditions at certain times in its history. It actually started in the 13th century, so you can imagine how people were treated back then. But anyway, in the mid-1800s, dogs, and you can see also birds there, were used. They were included in the wards to help the patients generally feel better. So it's got an old history, this. And I love this picture. This is Elaine Smith, who brought therapy dogs to the USA from England, started in England, which, you know, is renowned for its love of dogs. Brits are nuts about dogs, I have to say, having grown up there and being one. So there's Elaine with her therapy dog. And Therapy Dogs International is one of the larger therapy organizations now, therapy dog organizations. And this is Smokey. These are just a few random slides just to pique your interest. There's tons of stuff on the internet if you want to follow up. But Smokey was actually found on the battlefield and became a therapy dog. And he was owned by, I forget the name of the guy, Sergeant Wynne, I think his name was. But anyway, he helped the troops, and then after his owner was injured, he ended up in a hospital. And the guy who was in charge of Charles Mayo, who later went on to found the Mayo Clinic. And anyway, he permitted him to have his dog on the ward, and then the dog then helped all these other soldiers that were in hospital. And so there's one, according to the Animal Planet research, this was the first therapy dog. So whether you consider that Animal Planet has, you know, sufficient research skills for this to be a true statement, I'm not sure, but it was such a cute picture, I had to include it. And then just because this is a psychotherapy institute, the Process Work Institute, I thought I'd toss in a couple of photos of dogs who work with famous psychologists. Here's Freud with his chow, Yofi. And then Jung also had a dog, but I could only find this one really terrible picture of it. He looks more like a, I don't know, like a pig or something, I'm not sure. And then Arnold Mindell, who many of us know, who's the founder of the Process Work method of psychotherapy, also had a dog whose name was Cleopatra, and he has probably told, for those of you who know him, may have told you something about Cleo. He had her when he was a younger therapist, and he said he was shy to do stuff, and she wasn't. She did all sorts of outrageous things that he couldn't quite do with his patients. So let's look a little bit at the power of the human-canine bond. I think probably everybody that's here knows a bit about that. If you've got an interest in dogs, you probably have experienced dog somewhere in your life and how they touch us and do amazing things for us. But it's been going on for a long, 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 long time. Paleolithic era, the, you know, cave paintings with dogs, they've been important to us for a very long time. But the idea of dogs having therapeutic benefits, physiological, emotional, psychological, social, relational, spiritual, all those things, and getting it a bit more sort of formalized is a bit more of a recent phenomenon. But from the early 80s, there's been increasing research. I so nearly did my PhD on this, and I actually got books out of the Multnomah County Library and then took them back and did something else. And I'm not quite sure if I'm sorry about it or not, because it could have spoiled my whole interest in it by having to study it for 3 years, or else it was a bit of a waste that I didn't. But anyway, here we are, come around. Mm-hmm. And this is Olive, who's a dental therapy dog. I actually trained Olive, and she is a wonderful dog who, she was the third therapy dog of the woman, Julie, in the picture. And one of the things that those therapy dogs do is they lie on the kids while they're having their teeth done and calm them down, and they stroke them and cuddle with them. And they also show the dogs, like they do the dog's teeth, you know, so they're, and then they show the dogs how they brush their own teeth and all that kind of stuff. And that's all there. So here are just a few examples of things that people do with therapy dogs. Develop motor skills and coordination. They build empathy and compassion. Teach reading skills. Enable independent living is a huge one. Trauma healing. So much work has been done with dogs healing trauma, because often kids and adults find themselves able to tell dogs things that they just simply can't bring themselves to tell people. So sometimes just having a dog in the room helps to open up things. Also weight loss, you know, big thing, just having a dog that gets you out walking. So just a few, there's many, many more. Dogs in therapeutic settings. So Harvard has its own therapy dog, apparently. And that little dog relieves stress in students. They can actually come for 30 minutes of relaxation with that little dog and relieve the stress of high achieving at Harvard. And here's just some, just for those of you who are listening, this I'll just mention: mental health institutions, hospitals, nursing homes, hospices, rehab centers, independent and assisted living centers, behavioral health programs of all sorts, correctional facilities such as the one that Heather works at, veteran services, exercise programs, reading programs, and private practice of various sorts. So there's lots of places where therapy dogs are actually working with and for people. And tons of psychological benefits. I just, you know, I don't want to take too long with this part because I really want to get to the dog part, and they're both fast asleep as if nothing was going to happen, which is the difference between dogs and people. They're not worried at all about performing in a minute. You know, they just lie there, they are. When they're on, they're on. But so bonding, building relationship skills, being able to express emotion, build self-esteem, these are all things that dogs do in therapeutic contexts, particularly psychological therapy contexts. When they're working with psychologists, psychiatrists, counselors, other mental health professionals. They can be helpful in personal growth issues and development. They can help build control, inner control and external locus of control. They can be very helpful in self-harming or self-abuse behaviors, reducing those tendencies or actual behaviors. They can relieve anxiety, help with depression, and suicidal tendencies, ADHD. And in therapy, they can serve as a sort of therapeutic tool, if they'll excuse me for talking about them in those ways, in the sense that they can be used for assessment, as a projective tool, like the dog is feeling like this or the dog is doing like that, when actually it's the person. Role modeling, it's like, you know, how does the dog show the client how to relate in a more free or open way, just for example, or as storytelling and metaphor. So much as I would love to go into this more, if you're interested in this, I've got a reference at the end where you can read about this in much greater detail. But here, for example, this is an example of a goal and the kind of strategies that will be used by the therapist and or the handler with the dog to achieve those goals. So for example, if a client needed to have a greater sense of purpose, one thing they might do is provide care for the animal or look into ways that they might get a companion animal after they finished treatment. Of course, there are many other things, but this is just a couple of examples. And the interesting thing is that what therapists are finding is that in doing simple things for the dog, like brushing a dog, a person can then actually generalize that to other areas of their own life without a whole lot of cognitive stuff going on. And Heather's going to talk more about this. It's amazing how much can be achieved with how little in some situations. So here's another one, building self-esteem through learning a new skill or relearning or adapting a skill to, I don't know what that means, I'm just reading that aloud. So scrap that and let's go and look at the animal-assisted therapy strategy. So how somebody relates to the animal, treating the animal with respect, this is another thing where the projective thing comes in. It's like the animal is me. So if I'm treating that animal with respect, I'm also learning how to treat myself with respect. We are animals, and I think often learning how to talk, how to be with an animal in a different way helps us to be with our own animal self. Certainly for me, I've learned how to be better to my body as a result of relating to dogs over the years. You know, really having to feed my dog taught me how to feed myself better. And it wasn't a conscious cognitive process. It's just suddenly one day I thought, I'm going to make a protein shake instead of skipping breakfast because I was really working hard to feed my dog. I'm not going to go over read these one by one, but you know, as I'm talking, you can have a look at that. Here's another one, improving self-confidence. So as the client relates to the dog over time and the dog responds to the client more, that person then starts to feel like, oh, I'm somebody. The dog listens to me. I matter to the dog. I can tell the dog things and she actually does it. That kind of stuff. Again, providing care. And the fact that the animal recognizes you, this is something that as they went around you may have felt. It's like, oh, she's wagging her tail to say hello to me. And that makes you feel better. And you can imagine that someone who's never had somebody really feel, show any particular enthusiasm about them from childhood, when they come to therapy every time and that dog is ecstatic to see them, that makes a big difference in a person's life. So, same thing with the next one about improving self-image. So that's a general sort of personal development relationship with self example. And now this other example I wanted to use was one about anxiety. So it's not just personal growth issues, it's also serious clinical issues, clinical disorders, where working with a dog can be helpful. So I chose anxiety because it's so common and because it's something that I have suffered myself and also had the help of a dog for a while that really helped to relieve anxiety and actually probably as the result I didn't go on medication because of that dog's influence in my life. So holding and stroking an animal is, there's been lots of research done on the effects on blood pressure and general relaxation and a whole bunch of things which I won't go into. Talking to the animal and getting affection from the animal, from the dog, can relieve anxiety symptoms. Many people who suffer from anxiety and have a service dog, psychiatric service dog, to help relieve psychiatric conditions, that's a big thing, that they can actually bring themselves out of a post-traumatic stress incident, a panic attack, by simply having an animal to stroke or be with, or the dog may be trained to perform certain tasks that then will help relieve that stress or anxiety. Breathing with an animal can be incredibly powerful in relaxing you and bringing you out of an anxiety or a panic attack. Just going through, picking out a few different things here. Changing your thought patterns, which then prevent escalation into an anxiety attack. Sometimes therapists work with the animal and again, it's a sort of projective technique, like if the client explains why the animal shouldn't be afraid, they're also talking to themselves about why they don't need to be anxious either. And then if clients are frightened of being in certain places, having an animal go with them and be there and show that they're not afraid and that they're completely comfortable, again, there's a sort of like, there's a very porous barrier between us psychologically, between us and other dogs. And what one feels, the other can then start to feel and vice versa. Which brings me to the topic of therapy for the therapy dog. Because while it's totally wonderful what dogs do for us, it's also true that our anxieties and our stresses, because dogs are very emotional beings, they will also feel what we feel. So it's super important that they get a chance to decompress. And Most of the, you know, the bigger therapy dog organizations will be very particular when they're training teams to work in institutions with their dogs, that people know how to recognize signs of stress, and they put their dog's well-being first. So this dog was actually at my dog camp, which I hold every year for 60 dogs and their people, and this was a massage session, as it happens, and she was completely out. So the first thing, as I was mentioning, is the focus on the dog. Heather and I want to start this program where we provide a handler and a dog to work with psychologists, therapists, with their clients. And it can be very handy to have a handler who can focus on the dog while the therapist is focusing on the client. So whether it's your dog or whether it's a handler working with a therapy dog, it's important to know the dog's strengths and preferences and understand signs of stress in the dog's body, and that somebody is putting the dog's needs as important as anybody else's. Yes?
Can you give us some examples of how a dog might exhibit signs of
stress?
Yeah.
Usually, there'll be a restlessness in the body. Dogs' bodies don't lie. They show everything that they're feeling. Panting, licking their lips repeatedly, pinning their ears back. Sometimes you see sweaty paws from a dog who's very stressed. Yawning. If a dog's interacting with a client, a patient, and is uncomfortable, you'll see signs of like turning their head away. They'll be licking their lips. They might yawn again. They might start sniffing. They might shake off. So those are all ways that dogs both show signs of stress and also help to relieve stress. And I think Heather may talk more about that later.
A little bit.
So once you see those signs, or you know that your dog gets tired and just starts to look kind of droopy and less into it after a certain period of time, respecting those limits is super important. Otherwise, you'll end up having a dog who doesn't want to go to work with you, which would be a shame for the dog and for you and all the patients that benefit. Taking breaks is important, and being willing to end the session if necessary. Just nobody benefits when the dog's not having a good time. Giving back. This is a big one in my book. This is a picture I took of a Polish lowland sheepdog at my place in the country on the coast. And it's so important for dogs to be dogs. They live increasingly in a world that's very, very human complex, and they just need to get out and smell and run and roll in disgusting things and sniff each other and play and, you know, do stuff that dogs love to do. They have dreams. Dogs have dreams, I believe. In other words, you know, if once in their life a whole roast chicken lands in their lap, that's not a bad thing. If once in their life they get to go and do something that they really, really love, like June is a really, she loves, where is she? There she is, little June. Believe it or not, she's a total killer. She loves to go after rodents. So, you know, for June,
she would love a roast chicken
pie. She would also. Dogs have multiple dreams. So, you know, knowing your dog and knowing what they really love and providing opportunities for that from time to time is super important. So there's a couple of references. If you'd like to get that from me, my card's on the table. You can always email me, and I'm happy to send you that if you don't have something to write it down with. The CHIMO project is a Canadian project, and they have lots of sample goals and strategies for working with clients in therapeutic settings, and the Delta Society you can Google. So I think I want to wind up here and hand over to Heather. Thank you so much. And yes, one question. Yes.
Is that on the CHIMO?
That was drawn from the CHIMO website, yes. Mm-hmm. It was kind of condensed, but there's more of that expanded. Yeah.
So on the institutions and the dogs, I'm thinking of supply and demand. Are there more institutions that want dogs or more dogs that want institutions at this point?
I think more that want them than there
yes.
are. Yes.
There are more institutions that...
There is still a need for dogs.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a growing thing, but still, because not every dog can do it and there is training involved, I would say there's so many, many, many different possibilities, and they're growing all the time, that I think it'll be a long time before supply exceeds demand, actually. Yeah.
And there are environments, too, that you really need a specialized dog for. The correctional facility is very loud. There are a lot of people. People's emotions tend to range all over the place, and the dogs need to be able to manage that and not be overwhelmed with it. So there's not that many dogs that are comfortable in that environment.
So I'm just going to find the next one.
Go to Ed.
Oh, recent, yeah. That's it, yeah. That was what I was looking for. This
next one,
right?
Down. There.
All right.
Can I ask a question? Yeah.
Question?
I have two questions. One is, can any kind of dog be a therapy dog? And how long does it actually take to become a therapy dog?
Usually dogs that have, as long as they have not been trained for protection work, not every dog is suitable for therapy work, but any breed, pretty much as long as they haven't been trained for protection work. It really varies. The dog needs to be at least a year of age before they're actually working. But it depends on how much training you've put into the dog to begin with. If you've been training them since they were 8 weeks old, they might be ready at a year. But if you've just gotten the dog at a year, it just depends on each individual dog. All right, Thistle, come here. All right. Is this my... Oops. No, how do I do next, Caroline? That one. Thanks. There we go. So as Caroline had mentioned, there are a lot of traditional views of animal-assisted activities. Dogs are really good for... And that was a nice little shake-off that she just did. Are very good for calming people, for reducing anxiety. There's various ways you can do that. Thistle, come here. Thistle, lap. No. She's like, why are we in the front of the room? Thistle, come here. And this is the other thing with dogs, is they're not robots. They're not perfect, so they don't always perform for you when you want them to. Thistle, come here. Lap. Come on. No, Thistle, lap. She's like, no, I'm just done. Come here. Let me trade her out here.
Dogs.
Healy.
One and a spare.
Healy, come on, let's go. Healy doesn't like to do lap as much, come so here. That's why I had this out. Come on, Healy.
There you go.
Healy, there you go. Come on. Atta girl. Oh, my goodness. Come here. I know, it's already been a busy night. Healy, lap. No lap. Right now she's doing visits, so she gets confused a little bit. She doesn't really like these commands as much because she's not my super snuggly dog. But this is the our visit command, just to rest her chin. There you go, that's the lap. Thank you, Thistle. And Thistle normally really likes that one, so she'll stay in your lap till the cows come home. So she, it's a nice, firm pressure on people's laps.
Lap.
It helps calm them.
Lap.
You can pet them at that point. She's happy to just snuggle up and love with whoever, for a very long time. So if somebody's upset, they can pet the dog it makes it easier for them to talk. We have our little bag of tricks that I call it. So these are things that I bring with me on a therapy dog visit. There's things like a brush. There's some restricted areas that we work in that this is the only thing we can bring in with us is this rubber curry comb. But there's other areas where we can bring other things. We have like a foot balm, so Healy roll.
I'm going to run into the chair, miss. Healy roll.
Oh, that's a good girl. There you go. So this is a nice way for people to just kind of do a relaxing activity with the dog. And if anybody wants to do this, you're more than welcome to come up and do this. But they'll just rub the foot balm into the pads of her feet and just... work on relaxing and nurturing. Sometimes I work with a lot of people who struggled with their parenting skills. And so this is just a nice way for them to you know, learn how to take care of someone. I know you like that, huh, Healy? But we have, you know, toys and things like that in here that people can interact with the dogs with. And that's a very traditional view of what therapy dogs do, and it's very beneficial too. We go out onto units and the officers always say, oh, it's so nice after you leave because everything's so calm, or they'll have a big incident on the unit where somebody will do some self-harm and it causes a lot of trauma with everyone else, and just having the dogs out there kind of takes the edge off and redirects people's thoughts and anxieties and really helps calm an entire group down. So those are all very beneficial things. But there's also other portions of animal-assisted interactions that...
Just tell me, I'll move it.
Yeah, that would be great. Should I put it on? Thanks. And this is the animal-assisted therapy, where we have specific tasks that we teach skills to clients with. The interactions help mitigate their therapeutic goals. These are all measurable outcomes, and they assist with rapport building. So it's not, they're never miracle cures that we're doing. It's just... but it helps the therapist reach their clients in ways that they hadn't been able to before. So that is nice. Thank you. So one of the projects that I did with inmates at the correctional facility was we wanted to work on impulse control. So we took a group of clients that had poor impulse control, and obviously, you know, most of the people in the facility have issues with this. This is why they're there. But this was a particular group of people that the mental health specialists had selected. Some of them had been in trouble in the past. Some were currently in trouble. We had a lot of people spending a lot of time in segregation, a lot of time on what's called LOP status, which is loss of privilege status, which just means that they've been getting in trouble a lot. And it was for a lot of different things, a lot of assault, a lot of self-harm, disobedience, lots of assault with staff were a lot of their issues. So we wanted to see, could we lower the incidence of going to segregation with this group of people? The group that we worked with was age 21 to 53, I think. They all were diagnosed with various mental illnesses, which I think are listed on here, maybe not. All of them were on medication except for one. And we had, I think half of this group had IQs lower than 80, I think it was. And they all had varying times left on their sentence. So we wanted to see, could we teach them a skill with the dog that would help them just stop, process things, and think about things before they reacted? And so we did do what we called was Healy's reading program. So Healy knows how to read cue cards. So she has cue cards that tell her what her commands are. Let me take this off real quick. Healy. No, Healy. That's a good girl. There you go. So she just had the down cue card. Healy. No, Healy. She's like, stage fright. So we were not at all concerned with whether she was perfect on this or not. We had each inmate was assigned a word. They had their own cue card. And we stepped them through the process of teaching her how to read these cue cards. So they were all words that she knew on a verbal cue, how to do, she knows how to do a sit, she knows how to do a down. So we could start out stepping her through with, we taught them how to use a marker word, so they knew how to tell her when she did it correctly, they knew when to reward her, and they knew what to do if she didn't do it correctly. So each session, we would give them the instructions for that session. So it would look something like this. Healy, down. Yes. I'm sorry, I did that totally wrong. I would have shown the card first and then given her the verbal cue after several seconds. I should know this by heart by now. But we step through all these processes for 10 sessions with each of these inmates. And the sessions lasted about 10 or 15 minutes each. We had, let's see. So this is some photos. We had to blur out their faces, but you can't really tell in these anyways. and you can tell too, like, a lot of their arms were always bandaged from a lot of self-harm. But we had people that were pretty tough and pretty hard to reach. And you can't see it very well, but she has a big grin on her face doing this. So they were excited to participate in this. It was a big deal for them to do this. The other dog program that we have at the facility is for inmates that have really good behavior. This was a group that was never going to get to that status. They were never going to get into that elite dog program. So to them, this was a huge, big deal to participate. So they were excited about participating. They wanted to do this, and they were excited to tell people, this is what I'm doing. I'm teaching this dog how to read. How great is this? And you can see on each one, she's figuring out what these cue cards are. We had 11 people start this program, 10 of them completed it, and in a year's time, only one person, and it was the person who did not complete it, ended up going to segregation during that time. Oh, sorry.
So are they truly being taught to read?
No. Well, she's learning how to recognize symbols is what she's doing.
Well,
so,
I understand. Yes. But now that she knows.
Now that she
can
knows.
Can you use her on a new group of people?
Oh, I can introduce the same words, and she'll relearn the whole process. The whole concept was for the people to follow the directions, to say the command, you know, hold up the sign, say the command, wait so many seconds, and then follow through with her. So they had a process that they had to follow, and they had to wait and stop and think about things and follow all those directions. So it was actually more simple than what I'm making it sound, but it didn't matter if she learned how to read that card. They were excited and proud that they were completing this program. So, but she did. She learned what the cards were for each individual person, and by the end, everyone was successful at getting her to recognize those cue cards. So, our outcome that we wanted was less time in segregation. as you could saw on the previous screen, there were some people that had spent over half the year in segregation, which is a huge amount of time.
A quick question. So I just got what was happening. So what you're saying is that the inmates who had impulse control problems were having to go through this protocol with the dogs where they had to be patient. They had to think things through.
Yes.
They had to wait. They had to control their impulses.
Right.
And the reward was the dog's recognition of the command and the behavior.
Yes, and they also got to interact with a dog after their session was over, which was a big deal for them.
And so did you actually see, like, during the course of your study with these inmates, did you actually see, like, in the sessions with the dog, their behaviors change? Like, I'm imagining that some people initially could become very frustrated with the dog, like if it did what it did with you, you know, didn't immediately respond or did the wrong command.
Yeah, and they actually did pretty good. I mean, we followed our protocol call pretty closely, so it stepped her through the process of learning it very easily. So she came along just fine with her learning process, but you definitely saw a behavior change. When I had my first introduction session, all the mental health staff were like, my God, what did we get her into? Because we had this group of people all together and, you know, there was a lot of behaviors going on, a lot of people that had really short attention spans, and, you know, a lot of interrupting, a lot of yelling, a lot of, you know, and they were just like, oh my God, I don't know what we just did to her. But as soon as we started, all the staff were saying, oh my gosh, so-and-so is looking me in the eye now. And that had never happened before. Or, you know, so-and-so stopped, you know, assaulting staff, and now, you know, they've been out of segregation for an entire year. And, you know, they just saw all of these things happen with the people, and they were just amazed. And we didn't know if it was going to work. We just thought, oh, let's give it a try and see how it goes. And it really, disciplinary reports. Sorry.
Heather, could you just read those out? Because the people listening won't know what was reported by the staff.
So what the staff reported to me was that they were getting more eye contact from inmates, from these inmates. They are getting fewer or no disciplinary reports from these inmates. They had improved coping skills. There was increase in self-esteem, increased program participation, and better communication. And one of the things we noted that we had a lot of for the increased program participation for this, they'd be lined up at the door waiting. I want to participate in this. And staff would just be looking at that like, I've never seen this before with this person. They've never been excited to be a part of any program. So it was a really simple concept that seemed to work really well. And it's not just, you know, the act of teaching the dog to read, but it was also, you know, they felt like important that they got to do this. They felt a sense of self-esteem was raised because they were able to do this. They could say to people, I taught this dog to read. And it was just like so exciting for them that there were just a lot of components that kind of fed into why I think this ended up being so successful.
Oh, question. Mm-hmm. You said you weren't sure whether it'd work or not. I'm kind of interested in the institutional people and how you got the opportunity to try this out.
Yeah, that's a good question. That was not an easy task to do at all because they don't like to do research on the inmates. They don't want people using them as experiments. And so I run their dog program there, so I'm already working there. I was already a carded contractor that could go in and out of the facility, so they already allowed me in and out. And I had been doing therapy work in their mental health infirmary and on their mental health unit, and so I was already in contact with all the mental health staff. So when I worked with the mental health staff on developing this, we just hit the right people at the right time, and they said yes.
So you had existing relationships to work with?
Yeah. And since that time, we've tried to implement other programs too, and it's just been red tape. So it just, for this particular one, we hit the right people at the right time. And we're hoping to eventually get in there again and do other similar programs. But so Caroline had talked a little bit about the mental health professionals as the dog handler. And as she mentioned, that can be a little bit challenging because you are, you do need to be aware of your dog all the time. And that makes it hard for you to be aware of what's going on with your client as well. So that can be a little bit of a challenge for a therapist being a dog handler, but there's also the combination of the mental health professional plus the dog handler. So you've got one person that actually is focused in on the dog and is just paying attention to that, while the other person is focused in on the client and making sure that everything's okay with them. Because it's a living being. You need to make sure they're safe. You need to make sure that their needs are taken care of. But you can't also neglect your client. So it's a nice combination to have that. The training and the registration, not all dogs are suited for this work, but you can, if you've got a dog that really does well with people, does well in different environments, there are different organizations that you can work with to train your dog and then take a test to get your dog registered. It's nice to, the registration also usually includes insurance, so that's always nice, and then support as well. But they make sure that your dog also is healthy. You have to do health checks and fecal tests and things like that. So you, there are cases of zoonotic diseases that can be passed from dog to human. So you want to make sure that your dog's nice and healthy. So that's one of the things that a therapy dog organization will help monitor.
Excuse me, what was that term you used? Zoonotic?
Zoonotic. It's a disease that can go between humans and canines. So like Giardia is one. I'm just drawing a blank. Mm-hmm. And in the project that we did, there wasn't that much contact, so we had real limited exposure to that. So that was nice. Let's see if I missed anything here. I don't think so. Any questions?
What happens in a situation where you're at Coffee Creek and, like, for example, the dog didn't want to get on your lap, or and you're the client? How do you deal with that? Do you create a metaphor out of that? Because some people have such fragile self-esteems, and just curious.
Yeah, it actually that turns into,
or they wouldn't want to do the cue because, you know, we don't always want to do what we want.
Right. And that turns into a really nice teaching moment too. So, you know, exactly. You don't always want to do what people are telling you to do. And we can relate that to the dog as well. And I can also have her do something else. So she doesn't necessarily like to do laps, but I can have her do roll. And I know she'll do a roll because she loves to have her belly rubbed. So, you know, I can redirect the person to a different activity really quickly. I can just have her reposition her. Healy. What? Healy, heel. That's it. Come on. That's it. So I can have her just sit next to the person so that they can stroke her. She's pretty easy about, you know, going into the positions and getting close to people. She just doesn't necessarily like the tight hugs and things like that. So, you know, as her handler, I'm aware of what she likes and what she doesn't like, and I can tell people, oh, she doesn't really like that. And they're usually pretty good about saying, oh, okay, well, you know, what does she like and how can I interact with her in that way? And it's a good lesson for everybody. And there's a point where she also says, I'm done. And she'll back away from people and people get hurt, and I'll just say, you know, oh, sorry, she's been doing this for a couple of hours now and she's done, so we've got to call it a day. And people are usually pretty good. I mean, it's a lesson for them to learn how to handle that in a healthy way. And we do a lot of things with coping skills and things like that with the inmates too, so that they're doing less self-harm things. So, you know, we can certainly use that in that lesson.
We talked a lot about like self-harm and how others assault other people. How do you determine who your dogs work with in terms of their safety? Because obviously some people hurt animals, regardless if they're at Coffee Creek or not. And I just wondered how you dealt with that. Or
well, usually the mental health staff will guide me in the right direction, and they'll tell me who I need to steer clear from. But also there's officers, safety officers everywhere. So, I do a lot of body blocks if I need to. So I would step in front of my dog so that, she doesn't get harmed at all, but we haven't had an issue. We definitely have people, and I check with people, do you want to visit the dog? Because there's certainly people that do not want to get near the dog. There's a lot of people who've had backgrounds of being around dogs that are not, you know, that are used to being around the drug world, and they're not, you know, friendly pet dogs. So they're a little intimidated by the dog sometimes, and we'll work with those people as well to get them a little more acclimated if they want to. But if they don't want anything to do with the dog, you know, we don't push that at all. And there's some people that I've worked with for, took one woman 3 years, and she would get, you know, angry every time we came on the unit because she didn't want to be around, you know, her parents gave more affection to the dog. She didn't want anything to do with this dog. And, you know, 3 years later, and she comes right up and pats the dog. But I never approached her, never asked her to pet the dog, anything like that. It was all just her working through that, and then finally, you know, asking us if she could pet the dog, and now she, you know, very much wants to interact with the dog. So,
I know there's some people here who do work with their dogs also, so feel free not just to ask questions, but maybe to add comments or your experiences of working with your own dog in a therapeutic setting. That would be great to hear also from those of you who might like to do that. I'm not sure. Yeah?
So I just had a client recently that brought a dog to the session, mm-hmm. unexpected, and for the first few sessions, client brought the dog, and it seemed like it was new for me, so I didn't know quite what to. The dog just stood there, but it
the whole session, it just stood there.
they're just there, yeah.
Yeah,
but I'm wondering about encouraging clients to bring their pets and accessing, like, working with what the pet means to them and how they're an ally already for them. It's not like a therapy dog, but it's just their pet dog.
Yeah, well, I think it probably depends on where you work as to, you know, the extent to which you can welcome in miscellaneous animals to your practice. But if you have the luxury of working in a place where that's possible, then I think, you know, that would be a therapeutic judgment. Like, would that work for that client? And maybe get to know a bit about the animal before you say, right. yes, do bring it in if you don't want your carpet peed on or your furniture chewed up or something. You know, there's some people's version of a good dog or whatever is not necessarily going to be yours. So, but yeah, I think that's, rather than encourage it, but as with anything in a therapeutic process where you pick it up, and if it's something that's really salient for the client and could be a really good thing and it works for you in your setting, it could be great. Yeah, I mean, probably it could happen more than it does, actually, if we were a more animal-embracing culture that didn't sort of feel they should be all stuck at home somewhere. And just thinking of the lizard, like, didn't you, was it you, Lise, that talked about the lizard, right?
I know a student brought her lizard to school because it was talking to her.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, a lizard is a little more transportable than some other things. But, yeah, I would. That perhaps other people would have comments, other practicing therapists. Would you say, yeah, go ahead.
I would like to, as a client, mm-hmm. my wife and I as client, my wife brought our dog in, and I saw the therapist really reach out to the dog.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see immediately that was his way of reaching out to her in a safe way. You know, in other words, you build the bridges mm-hmm. where you can build the bridges.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good point.
Well, and definitely, you know, in a correctional facility, there's a strict no-touch policy. So this is a huge thing for them to be able to touch, you know, a physical live being. Some of the people that are incarcerated will be there for the rest of their lives, and some of them were incarcerated at a very young age. You know, I work with a girl who was 14 when she was incarcerated, and she'll be there the rest of her life. To go that long without touch is, you know, it's really tough. So, you know, it's a big, big deal to be able to actually physically touch them, and where we can't do that, at least, you know, we can bring in the dog and have the dog do that in a safe manner.
Mm-hmm.
They actually get consequences.
Oh, do you want to?
Oh, they get negative consequences for touching.
It's horrible.
Yeah, I had a couple of comments, things I wanted to share. So I'm a licensed clinical social worker in private practice, and I work primarily with older adults and folks with disabilities. And part of my work is in my office, and part of it is in the community in assisted living facilities or clients' homes and things like that. And I have my own dog. She's a year and a half, a little pug. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to learn more ways to really work with her therapeutically, but I've seen huge changes in people and in the way that they interact with the dog at you know, when I go to facilities, not just my client, but, you know, so many other people wanting to come and interact with the dog. And then in my office, it really seems to help break the ice, you know, and of course I screen people who want to, you know, come see me, you know, do you mind dogs? but it's worked out really, really nice. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I wanted to share was when I got the dog, what really prompted me to get her was my son, who at the time was 14 and going through serious depression. He was born with a medical condition that causes chronic pain, and he was just in incredible pain, suicidal. I mean, the worst place that anybody could be. We tried everything for the pain, everything for the depression. And when I brought home that puppy, his life totally changed.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. so this dog is also, we're working with Paws to Freedom, to train her as his service dog. Mm-hmm. And I've become such a advocate for folks. And I see a lot of older adults who, unfortunately, the places that they live don't allow them to have pets, or, you know, they lose the ability to care for them as much as the facility would like them to. So they ask them to take the pet. And I'm working with a woman now who lost her dog, and it's just so hard. Mm. So hard.
Mm.
So thank you.
And they do open up the door for talking about certain things. I don't know where Thistle went. Oh, Thistle's over there.
Thistle's working.
So Thistle was also a breeder for a service dog organization. And so she has her little breeder scarf that has all her baby's names on it. And this opens up the doors to talk to women about their children, about their babies that they don't get to mother when they're inside the facility. So, you know, the dogs make a great opening for that kind of conversation with clients too.
Well, I we adopted a couple rescues, and I'm also a licensed clinical social worker in private practice, and I just started bringing one of them to work. And she's just a natural, but I mostly brought her to work because I just love having her around. Mm-hmm. And she's been wonderful. She's not that well trained, and there's treats in the office, and she's a very food motivated dog. I found out after the fact that she had been rescued from a hoarding situation down in California. So I think that hunger will always be an issue for her.
Mm-hmm.
But she's just a natural, and there's maybe, I think of all my clients, there's maybe three who aren't comfortable with dogs, and she just stays in the crate, and she's happy to be in there. I usually give her a treat while she's in there. I don't know anything about whether, you know, the fact that some of the clients give her treats, I mean, that gives them pleasure, but she'll take her treat, she'll give them a little bit of attention, and then she goes in her crate.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's certain clients she intuitively knows are out in the waiting area, and she'll wander out there to get them. And they just are so tickled. She's just this little mutt. I think she's possibly Border Terrier and maybe Cairn Terrier. And she's just a mess. And but I have one client who's 79 who came in, and her presenting problem was that she was grieving the loss of her beloved dog, that she never had her own child, and this was her child, and that dog had been gone for a year. Well, she's dealt with all of the things she came in to deal with, but she doesn't want to stop coming in, so she comes in once a month just to see my dog. And so, I don't know, I mean, it's just, she's just there, but she's not really doing any kind of therapy. I guess it would be under the... activities, but she really creates a lot of comfort.
Mm. Well, there's, you know, in our world, we're very goal and outcome oriented now in clinical practice and stuff, but some things don't really translate. Well, you can put them into things like the tasks that we've, you know, you have to do that for the human agency point of view, but actually just their being is therapeutic. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons they're so powerful. We have to list it as tasks, but they're just being dogs, and something about that works for us as well. So it's great you have her, and that she found you after a rough beginning.
Oh my gosh. I've been in the field for 20 years. I had just lost my service dog therapy dog on Christmas Eve, and we started the Dove Lewis Animal Assisted Program. And she was 14, and she would, her last week, she was the pillow for a young boy who had cystic fibrosis, and he died laying with her. For a whole week, we spent in ICU with him. And she didn't want to leave unless I literally, like, had to pick her up and carry her out of the ICU room, because she just knew that what he needed was for him to lay on her. And I know in the last 14 years, with all my disabilities, she's helped me through 6 brain surgeries, 5 years of breast cancer treatment and surgery. And I wouldn't have made it. She was with me every treatment. She laid out when I had radiation. I didn't want her in the room with me because I didn't want her to be radiated. But she laid outside the door waiting. And we visited the nursing home. And now the last 4 years I've lived with my mom, helping my mom. So I live in Assumption Village, which is a senior kind of complex, and we're going through counseling, the whole group. I've gotten some counselors in because she became their therapy dog, and it took us an hour in the morning to go from upstairs to downstairs to the mailbox because everybody had to do their good morning thing, and she played bow a million times in a day. And it's just amazing. There was a whole lot of transitions and things happening. So, but I've been working in the field a long time. I've seen people come out of comas by taking the animals in and stroking their hands on the dogs and that connection and things like that. So if anybody has any questions, I can answer some questions about Delta and different things and how it interacts for people and what helps.
My work is in hospice. I'm a hospice chaplain, and primarily I don't go in hospitals, but I'm in the assisted livings and adult foster homes and private homes. And I've seen remarkable movement in some of my clients as they have completely dull affects with end-stage Alzheimer's and end-stage dementia. And I'll bring in my dog, and she's a Labradoodle. And they won't be responsive to any of the people in their environment. And the minute the animal gets close, the minute Maggie gets close to them, their entire affect will change. It's as if the window opens and the lights come on, the smiles appear, and the hands that have been folded and contracted start to reach out to touch the animal. And I am always amazed. There are faces that I see that fit the description that I just gave, and there's others that are in bed that have lost their will to live, that are waiting to die. They heard the diagnosis and now they're waiting, and so depressed that there's no reason to get out of bed. And when Maggie comes in the room, they'll turn over from facing the wall, and they'll pat on the bed, and Maggie will jump up with them. And again, the demeanor changes. The will to take another breath is visible. The smiles appear, and the embraces start. And for those moments, life is again worth living. And the mind has been distracted from the process of dying to actively engaging in something that's worth engaging in. And it's wonderful to see these individuals that the people that come into them are trying to service them, to get them to eat, to get them to change them, to do something to them. And they no longer want to have anything done to them. And when the dog comes in, it's not about anything that this dog is going to do to them. It is an offering for them. And that just seems to open up so many doors for words that can be spoken when they have their arms wrapped around an animal that has no expectation mm-hmm. from them.
I have a question. I don't know who could answer it really, but I also work for a hospice. I'm a nurse, and we don't currently have a program, but there's a lot of interest in it. And I'm just wondering, from technically, if there's a lot of difficulty getting healthcare institutions to accept this, or if it's generally well accepted. I'm just thinking of infection control people maybe having a problem with it, anything like that, or if it is most of the hospitals are okay with dogs.
I think, and somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think most of the hospitals are pretty okay with it in most areas, but they definitely have protocols for people to follow, and they may have may require more frequent testing for parasites, things like that, and definitely the organizations also require baths within 24 hours of a visit, so that's definitely a requirement for hospitals as well.
Also, there some big institutions will only accept certain certifications. So, for example, I think, what's the hospital that's just around here? Good Sam? Yeah, I think Good Sam will only take Delta, or it did a couple of years ago. So Delta tends to be, it's the biggest organization, it probably has the hugest insurance, it has probably the strictest criteria, and some hospitals in particular will only take, say, Delta certified teams. But it's also true that some places just so much want dogs, they don't care if you're even certified. They'll just take a visiting person and a dog. So
I work at Southwest Washington Medical Center, mm-hmm. and they're very lenient.
Yeah.
Even some of the patients allow them to bring their animals in, as long as they're mm-hmm. well behaved, you know, to come in to visit mm-hmm. their patient and see their family.
Mm-hmm. I was just at Kaiser, and I was taking a friend over to Kaiser, and I walked into the lobby, and I have a service dog myself. Out of the corner of my eye, instantly I went, oh, service dog, okay, you know, and come to find out, it's actually a Kaiser employee that has their dog certified, and also Kaiser encourages for well health and well-being more dogs coming through.
That's good.
Because I started, as soon as I see dogs and stuff, I start picking brains. So mm-hmm. that was, and come to find out, Kaiser is starting up their own way of bringing dogs into the workplace, not only for employees, but for patients.
Great. That reminds me also, while the mic goes to you, we were going to speak about the notion of dogs who actually belong to a facility. So mm-hmm. rather than being brought in by a team, they actually are attached to a facility. So Heather, whether you say that now or maybe after your question.
I just wanted to mention the canine good citizen test. And mm-hmm. My dog passed that, but she was a little young when I took her for the Delta one, but it's pretty tough. But a lot of places, if you have the canine good citizen, that's good enough, mm-hmm. and their current vaccinations.
Mm-hmm. Well, most of the organizations also base their testing off of the canine good citizen. They just make it a little more difficult. So they add additional distractions, add a different noises, different stronger criteria to get through it. So the canine good citizen test is a real good place to start if you're interested in getting your dog mm-hmm. registered as a therapy dog. And Caroline was mentioning the facility dogs. I also work for an organization called Canine Companions for Independence, and they do one of their dogs that they train service dogs, but they also train facility dogs. And those are dogs that go to work with a professional and work full-time with that professional. So it's usually in hospitals and, you know, physical therapists. They've actually got some in the court systems now. So they will go and testify with children. There's a wide variety of placements that they have, and those dogs are provided free of charge to the recipient. You just need to go through a rigorous application process and then go down for a two-week training where they match you up with a dog, and they provide lifetime support for training of that dog. So there's, I think, some bookmarks and things up there that have the contact information for CCI if you're interested in that as well.
You may have just answered this. I was just wondering if there's a centralized number if someone happened to need a therapy dog, let's say for a court appearance or for some type of a dental situation or some event was coming up, is there a centralized number then that would dispatch and match?
The different therapy dog organizations, if you contact them, they will put the word out that a therapy dog's needed in a certain situation, and usually they can find somebody. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's like a highly trained team. You can always, you know, specify, I need somebody that can do this specific kind of task, and see if there's anybody out there that has those skills. But, you know, if you just need like comfort, you need a dog right there in a specific situation. But you always need to check also with the place that you're bringing the dog, because therapy dogs don't have public access rights. Actually, no dogs have public access rights. People do, but it's people with disabilities that have the public access rights with their service dogs. So therapy dogs don't have, aren't allowed into public places like service dogs are. They're allowed by invitation, essentially.
I'm kind of surprised I haven't heard the word process work mentioned once in your entire presentation. And actually, I'm a little relieved because I thought it would be entirely about all the edges and whatever else. But I think there might be something you want to say around the bridge between what you just presented and process work.
That's probably my job.
Go, Caroline.
Heather doesn't have any background in process work, so that would be a hard one for you, right? So what was your question again? What's the connection between the two, process work and this?
And you don't have time for a whole lecture, but I mean,
no.
what point would you want to make around the connection between what you're doing and process work?
Well, I think the connection is really just a personal one, that we happen to be doing this here because of my history here and the knowledge that people in the process work learning community might be interested in this. And so some people are here because they have a connection with this center, but a lot of people are here because it just happens to be the place it's being held. So in terms of my personal connection, I don't think there isn't really a lot of connection at this point, in any more than, you know, if I was a gestalt therapist or if I was a transactional analyst or I was a psychoanalyst who was interested in therapy with dogs, like using dogs in therapy, the connection would simply be through me as an individual practitioner who happens to want to use a dog in my practice. And more than that, I probably wouldn't say here, because it would actually involve explaining a whole lot of stuff about a particular therapeutic approach that I don't think most people are here to actually know about. So in order to make a connection between that therapeutic approach and this kind of work, I'd have to go on and on about process work, which I'm not going to do tonight. But for those of you that might be interested, I'm happy to talk about that in more detail afterwards.
I guess I'll point out one thing that I'm seeing, this whole idea of edge, where you get to a point where you can't make a breakthrough, over and over again in all these examples.
Yeah.
Where the dog is helping the person cross an edge into
right.
a sort of a different kind of behavior.
Yeah.
And I guess that's just one example of what I think you can do if you wanted to play with that.
Sure, absolutely.
You or anybody. You've done a great job.
Mm-hmm. No, I think your point's taken. In different therapeutic approaches, there's a different languaging for human experience and the process of therapeutic change. So, but I think you put your finger on a really important point, which is that dogs somehow help to take us where we can't go by ourselves, or where we have extra difficulty going just by ourselves. I think that's the role of a therapist, to help us go beyond where we've gone before in our own personal journey, engaging whatever resources we have on that journey. And I think that's why we named the thing dogs as therapists, because just by being what they are, they help to make that happen. And personally, I remain somewhat just amazed by them, like by their beingness and what it does for us. And I think also what that says about our relationship. This is cutting out. You know, that we have to have had a very, very, very long history together, that we have such a powerful connection with them. And it's true that other animals can do it, but there's something about dogs that seems to be particularly therapeutic. So what that is still remains something mysterious to me, and that's part of its beauty also.
If I may share, coming from a perspective of a patient,
mm-hmm.
I have been in psychotherapy, I have been in counselor's offices, I've been in social worker's offices, I have been institutionalized, I have been declared to a point that I should not be able to live on my own, I should be drug dependent, I should be an alcoholic, I should be obese, I should be very, very not a pleasant person. My severity of post-traumatic stress disorder, when they tested me, came up a severity of a extreme war veteran from my childhood. The only reason why I am alive today is because of my dog, Lady, who was given to me at birth and went through the fifth grade with me. Ginger, who I begged and begged my dad to rescue, was with me from a little, about a year after Lady had died, until my high school years. And Ginger was my therapist. And then as I got older, I got another dog. And then I didn't have a dog for years. I became very ill. I came extremely ill. I couldn't go into society very well. And then when I was in society, it wasn't well at all. As time went on, I didn't realize how much I relied on my animal, my dog. Now here I am in a process of getting and having a service dog trained for me. I am now diagnosed with Parkinson's, and I have what's called cataplexy, which is a neurological disorder that you just all of a sudden lose all your neurological muscle control, and you fall to the ground. And it has to do with a deep seated root of post-traumatic stress. And many times I would put my dogs in the car because I would not drive off the bridge if my dog was in the car. I would not put myself in harm's way, because that would mean I would put my dog in harm's way.
Mm.
I would knock over any hill, any mountain, anybody, if they came between me and my dog. Mm. But you could run me over in a heartbeat. But don't touch my dog.
Mm-hmm.
So what it taught me was boundaries for myself, taught me care for myself, in a way that sitting in a therapist's office, they could speak to me till they were blue in the face.
Mm-hmm.
But when it came to me being able to take the care of my animal, my horses and my dogs, and then put it into me and love me as much as I love them, mm-hmm. and them loving me as much as, you know, it was... That is where, to this day, I am alive and well as well gets, and as normal gets, because of where my, as you've said, Carolyn, my relationship with the animals and the animal within me, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. I am a living miracle, and I have been written up in medical journals as such. And I do not take credit for that. It is the people who have worked with me and work with my dogs with me. And I tell you what, a bag of dog food is a lot cheaper than $500 an hour.
That is a really wonderful statement possibly to wrap up with. Thank you. Awesome. What an eloquent statement of the power of dogs as therapists. So I'm wondering if we might start to wind up now, just with a little bit of a an invitation, really, that if you do have a personal interest perhaps in teaming up with a therapy dog, if you don't have access to a dog for your practice, or if you have some other personal interest in therapy with dogs for you or for your clients or somebody else that you might know, perhaps you might want to talk with us afterwards. We are getting a program off the ground where we provide a dog and handler for therapists to work with in various settings. So if you might be part of that, might be interested in some way, just afterwards. And I think this microphone has actually decided that it's time off. So I want to thank you all very, very much for being here, for all your contributions, for who you are and the dogs you bring with you in your hearts. I'm glad that you talked about them. Thanks very much to the dogs for being here. And thank you, Heather. It's really a pleasure working with you. So thank you very much. And thanks again to the Process Work Institute for hosting this, to Miriam for all your hard work, and Cindy for actually inviting us in the first place. Don't forget to take some materials if you're interested in finding out more about the center and anything else. And have a great evening.
Thank you so much, Caroline and Heather and Healy and Thistle. Thank you.
Yeah.